Lincoln, Disc 5.
The earnestness of Lincoln's efforts to impose rationality on public life reflected his intense internal struggle to bring coherence to his own still unshaped personality. He was not yet sure who he was or how he wished to be perceived. He liked to associate with the aristocratic element of Springfield, who gathered around the wealthy and snobbish Ninian W. Edwardses, but he also wanted, as he said, to be one of the boys, the young and active working men and clerks, who time after time supported his election to the state legislature. In his role of courteous gentleman, he could write a gallant letter to Mrs. Browning, urging her to accompany her husband to the meeting of the legislature in Springfield, where he promised to render unto your honorous due attention and faithful obedience. But he knew that many in the House of Representatives joined Ewing in thinking him a coarse and vulgar fellow. He wanted to be regarded as a generous opponent, unwilling to hurt the feelings of a colleague, yet, with his high temper still not under control, he was capable of flaring up in debate and truculently announcing that if his opponents wanted to settle a dispute at another tribunal, he was always ready and never shrunk from responsibility. He thought of himself as a speaker who advanced strong, logical arguments. Yet he learned from the Democratic Illinois State Register that many deplored his habit in his public appearances of putting on a sort of assumed clownishness in his manner, which doesn't become him and which doesn't truly belong to him. Even Lincoln's style betrayed his inner uncertainty. In most of his public speeches and legal papers, he kept to simple, pithy statements, notably devoid of ornamentation or rhetorical flourish. But on occasion, as in the Lyceum address, he adopted the florid style so common in 19th-century oratory. America need have no fear of foreign invasion, he boasted. All the armies of Europe, Asia, and Africa combined, with all the treasure of the earth in their military chest, with a Bonaparte for a commander, could not by force take a drink from the Ohio or make a track on the Blue Ridge in a trial of 1,000 years. Or, in the unlikely context of defending the National Bank, he announced, "If ever I feel the soul within me elevate and expand to those dimensions not wholly unworthy of its almighty architect, it is when I contemplate the cause of my country, deserted by all the world beside, and I standing up boldly and lone in hurling defiance at her victorious oppressors. Here, without contemplating consequences, before high heaven and in the face of the world, I swear eternal fidelity to the just cause of the land of my life, my liberty, and my love." Similarly conflicted and contradictory were his attitudes toward women. Lincoln liked women, and he wanted to know them. A month after he moved to Springfield in 1837, he lamented, "I've been spoken to by but one woman since I've been here, and shouldn't have been by her if she could have avoided it." But he was awkward and uncomfortable when he was around them. He didn't know how to behave. Sometimes he turned up for evening affairs wearing his rough Conestoga boots, and he once disrupted a party by commenting, "Oh, boys, how clean these girls look." He met eligible young women primarily at the Sunday soirees that Ninian and Elizabeth Edwards held at their luxurious mansion. Edwards was a snob who found Lincoln a mighty rough man. but this ambitious son of a former Illinois governor thought the young lawyer might be politically useful. Elizabeth Todd Edwards's ambitions were matrimonial. She seemed always to have as a guest an unmarried friend or relative who was looking for a husband. She'd just married off one sister, Frances, to a local physician, William Wallace, and was ready to welcome others from her Kentucky home. Around the Edwardses gathered the brightest and best of Springfield society. The handsome and soldierly John J. Hardin, a relative of Mrs. Edwards, and likely candidate for Congress, attended most of their parties. So did Edward D. Baker, the enormously popular young Whig orator, who might one day have aspired to the presidency but for his British birth. O.H. Browning represented the conservative, better-educated element of the Whig Party. Though the Edwardses were staunch Whigs, their soirees were nonpartisan, and they welcomed Stephen A. Douglas, now the leading Democrat in the state, already known as the Little Giant because his power belied his size, Democrat James Shields, the handsome Irish-born state auditor, was often a guest. The Edwards entourage included the most attractive young women in Springfield. From time to time, Ninian Edwards welcomed a relative, such as his niece, the beautiful and pious Matilda Edwards. Julia Jane, daughter of a Springfield doctor, nearly always attended the Edwards parties, as did Mercy Ann Levering when she was visiting from Baltimore. But nobody in the Edwards circle attracted more interest than Mrs. Edwards's younger sister, Mary Todd. The daughter of Robert S. Todd, a prosperous merchant and banker of Lexington, Kentucky, Mary had grown up in luxury, attended by family slaves and educated in the best private schools. Unable to get along with her stepmother, she decided, after a preliminary jaunt in 1837, to pay her sister an extended visit in 1839. Immediately, this small, pretty young woman of 22 years, with beautiful fair skin, light chestnut hair, and remarkably vivid blue eyes, enchanted the other members of the group. Even Herndon, who came to hate her, described Mary as young, dashing, handsome, witty, cultured, graceful and dignified, though he also noted that she could be sarcastic, haughty, aristocratic. She was an excellent conversationalist, Herndon continued, and she soon became the belle of the town, leading the young men of the town a merry dance. Abraham Lincoln was one of those who danced in attendance. Literally so, since he first met Mary Todd at one of the Edwards parties and told her he wanted to dance with her in the worst way. And, Mary laughed, he did. Lincoln was enchanted by this vivacious, intelligent young woman, and soon he was one of her regular attendants at parties, on horseback rides, on jaunts to neighboring towns. Mary was entirely different from anyone he'd ever known. He didn't even feel awkward when talking to her, for she made up for his deficiencies as a conversationalist. Mrs. Edwards recalled that when they were together, Mary led the conversation. Lincoln would listen and gaze on her as if drawn by some superior power, irresistibly so. He listened, never scarcely said a word. Lincoln, she added, couldn't hold a lengthy conversation with a lady, wasn't sufficiently educated and intelligent in the female line to do so. He was charmed with Mary's wit and fascinated with her quick sagacity, her will, her nature and culture. In receiving Lincoln's attentions, Mary had to think of him, as she did of the other young men who gathered around her, as a potential husband. Marriage was now very much on her mind. She was just short of becoming an old maid, and, except for school teaching, no other career was open to women of her class. There weren't many eligible bachelors. She very much liked Douglas, with whom she flirted outrageously, to their mutual amusement, but both quickly recognized that his mind was on his career, and he wasn't seriously interested in matrimony. She found Speed handsome and charming, but he seemed attracted to the devout Matilda Edwards. The widower Edwin B. Webb, another Springfield attorney, was an earnest suitor, but he suffered from the disadvantages of being considerably older than Mary and of having what she called two sweet little objections, the children of his first marriage. She was realistic enough to recognize that, despite all the attentions she received, my beaux have always been hard bargains. By comparison, Lincoln looked increasingly attractive. He lacked social graces, but his honesty, his courtesy, and his considerateness compensated for the deficiency. They shared many interests. Both were Kentuckians. Both loved poetry and had memorized many of the same poems, especially those by Robert Burns. Like him, she was a Whig. At a time when women weren't supposed to profess an interest in politics, she openly supported Harrison for president in 1840. Though, like Lincoln, she would have preferred Henry Clay, a friend of her family and a neighbor in Lexington. She was pleased by Lincoln's ambition. In Kentucky, she'd often said jokingly that she intended to marry a man who would someday become President of the United States. By the fall of 1840, she and Lincoln were edging toward a closer relationship. And that prospect may have contributed to his sometimes boisterous conduct toward his fellow legislators, and even to his much-publicized leap from the State House window. The Edwardses favored the match. Ninian Edwards said he desired it for policy. He didn't explain his meaning, but doubtless he had in mind linking to his already influential family a promising young lawyer and politician. Mrs. Edwards also encouraged it, recognizing that Lincoln was a rising man. Sometime around Christmas, Abraham and Mary became engaged. Once Lincoln had made a commitment, he began to have second thoughts, much as he'd done in his engagement to Mary Owens. It was as if he was reluctant to marry anyone who was willing to accept him. He began to suspect that the Edwardses had planned the match and had maneuvered him into proposing. Belatedly, though with some reason, he worried about his ability to support a wife. He had now an income of more than $1,000 a year from his legal practice, plus his salary as a state legislator. But neither source was certain. His law partnership was about to be dissolved. Stewart, who'd been in Washington for most of the past 2 years, had contributed little to the practice, and, now that his re-election to a second term in the House of Representatives was virtually conceded, it made no sense to continue his empty partnership with Lincoln. Lincoln wasn't even assured of his income from the state legislature. With the collapse of the internal improvements system and the resulting bankruptcy of the state, he and his associates had come under increasingly bitter and sometimes personal attack. His political popularity was declining. In the 1840 election, he was no longer the candidate who received the most votes, and in the rural precincts there was a movement to reject him. and the other members of what was termed the Springfield Junto. He resolved not to stand for re-election when his present term in the legislature expired. Thus, in 1840, he was a man without reliable income, who had no savings and owned no house, but probably still owed something on his national debt from his New Salem days. He knew he couldn't give Mary the life of wealth and luxury to which she was accustomed. These anxieties covered his deeper uncertainties about marriage. Like Speed, with whom he shared his most intimate thoughts, he was probably still sexually inexperienced. Both young men had grown up in a rough frontier society where, except in family arrangements, men and women kept largely to themselves, and where, in all male gatherings, there was much big talk and rough humor about sex, and usually much less experience. Both young men had highly romantic notions about women and marriage. As Lincoln wrote his friend later, "It's the peculiar misfortune of both you and me to dream dreams of Elysium far exceeding all that anything earthly can realize." At the same time, they shared forebodings about marriage, which evoked fears of something indescribably horrible and alarming. Probably they were anxious about their own, as yet untested, sexual adequacy. In addition, they must have worried about how to go about transforming the adored object of chaste passion into a bed partner. Both Lincoln and Speed rationalized their fears as apprehension that they didn't love their fiancées as they should. In Lincoln's case, all these anxieties were heightened by Speed's decision to sell his interest in his store on January 1st in preparation for a return to Kentucky in the spring. Lincoln had to move out of the upstairs room they shared and find lodgings with William Butler. A very private person, Lincoln was about to lose his best and closest friend at just the moment when he was being rushed into a new, potentially very dangerous, kind of intimacy with Mary. The man who wanted to live in a universe governed by cold reason found himself awash on a sea of turbulent emotions. His nerve snapped. He decided he had to break the engagement, and he wrote Mary a letter saying that he did not love her. Speed tried to persuade him to burn it. "If you think you have will and manhood enough to go and see her and speak to her what you say in that letter," he told him, "you may do that. Words are forgotten. But once you put your words in writing and they stand as a living and eternal monument against you." Reluctantly, Lincoln accepted his friend's advice and went to the Edwards mansion. When he told Mary he didn't love her, she burst into tears. At first, she blamed herself, remembering a young man in Kentucky whose attentions she'd deliberately encouraged only to spurn him. She exclaimed, "The deceiver shall be deceived. Woe is me." Deeply moved, Lincoln drew her down on his knee, kissed her, and parted. When he told Speed what had happened, his friend said, "The last thing is a bad lick, but it can't now be helped," and he assumed the engagement still stood. But after Lincoln left, Mary brooded over the reason of his change of mind, heart, and soul, and concluded, without any real justification, that he was in love with Matilda Edwards. She wrote Lincoln a letter releasing him from his engagement, yet letting him know that she would hold the question an open one, that is, that she hadn't changed her mind, but felt as always. Instead of feeling relieved, Lincoln was devastated. Just as Mary Owens's refusal had caused him to suspect that he really loved her, so Mary's letter made him realize what he'd lost. He became deeply depressed. During the first week in January, he was able to go about his business, in a more or less perfunctory way, and to answer roll calls in the House of Representatives. But then the burden of guilt and unhappiness became too great, and he took to his bed for about a week, unwilling to see anybody except Speed and Dr. Henry. During this period, some of his friends feared he might commit suicide. Years later, Speed said he'd felt obliged to remove razors from his room, take any all knives and other such dangerous things. But a fellow legislator who boarded with Lincoln at Butler's house recalled, "His most intimate friends had no fears of his injuring himself. He was very sad and melancholy, but being subject to these spells, nothing serious was apprehended." His mind was in turmoil as he reflected on what he'd done and how he'd acted. Bitterly, he reproached himself for inconstancy. "My own ability to keep my resolves when they're made," he told Speed, "was once the source of pride, as the only, or at least the chief, gem of my character. Now, that was lost. He was haunted by the never-absent idea that he'd made Mary unhappy. That still kills my soul," he wrote his best friend. "I can't but reproach myself for even wishing to be happy while she's otherwise." By the end of January, he was able to resume his routine work, but in a listless, sporadic fashion. "I have within the last few days been making a most discreditable exhibition of myself in the way of hypochondriaism," he told Stewart on January 20th. But he couldn't control his emotions even long enough to offer an explanation. "I haven't sufficient composure to write a long letter," he informed his partner. 3 days later, his condition hadn't improved. "I'm now the most miserable man living," he informed Stewart. "If what I feel were equally distributed to the whole human family, there wouldn't be one cheerful face on the earth." Lincoln's collapse became the subject of public comment and gossip. Some of his acquaintances, not aware of the seriousness of his illness, were lighthearted about Lincoln's having had 2 cat fits and a duck fit. Better informed, James C. Conkling wrote Mercy Levering that after a week in the sick room, Lincoln is reduced and emaciated in appearance and seems scarcely to possess strength enough to speak above a whisper. His case at present is truly deplorable. The Edwardses said flatly that he was crazy. Presently, there were rumors about the causes of his depression. Springfield concluded that Lincoln was grieving because Mary Todd had broken their engagement. In this scenario, Lincoln appeared, as Conkling wrote, "a poor, hapless, simple swain who loved most true but was not loved again." During the following months, Lincoln tried to bring his life back under control. Dropping out of the Edwards social circle, he no longer saw much of his friends, and, as Conkling rightly suspected, he tried to drown his cares among the intricacies and perplexities of the law. In April, he took a major step toward solving his financial uncertainties by entering into law partnership with Stephen T. Logan. From the outset, Logan and Lincoln, with an office on the east side of North Fifth Street, had many clients. But Lincoln, who probably received a third rather than one half of the fees, didn't make a great deal of money. He was still unhappy and far from well. In August, he decided to visit Speed, who'd returned to Kentucky, and for nearly a month, he stayed at Farmington, the Speed home near Louisville. In that spacious mansion, built by skilled Philadelphia artisans around 1809, he experienced a life of leisure that he'd never known before. Everything was arranged for his comfort. One of the house slaves was even assigned to be his personal servant. Lincoln took long walks in the fields with Joshua. He made friends with Mary, Joshua Speed's half-sister, and on trips into Louisville, he met his brother James Speed, who lent him books from his law library. The devout Mrs. Speed, observing that he was still very melancholy, had long motherly talks with him and presented him with a Bible, urging him to read it, to adopt its precepts, and pray for its promises. "I intend to read it regularly when I return home," he promised, adding equivocally, "I doubt not that it's really the best cure for the blues, could one but take it according to the truth." All in all, it was a most successful vacation, and Lincoln was so charmed by his Kentucky experiences that he didn't even wince when, on the steamboat returning home, he encountered 12 chained slaves, strung together precisely like so many fish upon a trot line. A gentleman was taking them from their Kentucky homes to the Deep South, where, Lincoln recognized, the lash of the master is proverbially more ruthless and unrelenting than any other where. Years later, he would remember the brutality of the scene, but now, absorbed in his own unhappiness, he noted only that the slaves were the most cheerful and apparently happy creatures on board. In Kentucky, he came to realize that Speed was facing a psychological crisis much like his own. His friend was engaged to Fanny Henning, a vivacious girl with what Lincoln called heavenly black eyes. But as the time for marriage neared, he began to have second thoughts. He worried that he didn't love Fanny as he should. Back in Springfield, Lincoln watched the development of the affair with almost painful interest, and he sent a stream of letters designed to keep his friend's spirits up and to encourage him to marry. In effect, Lincoln and Speed were acting out a game of doctor and patient. In the winter of 1840-41, Lincoln had been the sufferer and Speed had offered encouraging advice. Now it was Speed who was at risk, and Lincoln was trying to save his health and sanity. In arguing with Speed, Lincoln was also arguing with himself. Did his friend fear he didn't love his fiancée enough? "What nonsense," Lincoln exclaimed. Speed hadn't courted Fanny for her wealth because she had none, and he hadn't wooed her because she was moral, amiable, sensible, or even of good character. He'd asked her to marry him because he'd fallen head over heels in love with her. After Speed confessed to excessively bad feeling when Fanny became seriously ill, Lincoln took this as an indubitable evidence of your undying affection for her. "Why, Speed," he reasoned, "if you didn't love her, although you might not wish her death, you'd most calmly be resigned to it." As the date for Speed's marriage approached, Lincoln warned that it was probable that your nerves'll fail you occasionally for a while. But he predicted that all would be well if his friend avoided exposure to bad weather, which, he noted, "my experience clearly proves to be very severe on defective nerves," and didn't allow himself to be idle. "In 2 or 3 months, to say the most," he predicted, "you'll be the happiest of men." Once the wedding took place, a different note entered Lincoln's letters. He awaited, with intense anxiety and trepidation, Speed's report on his marriage. When Speed reported that he was far happier than he ever expected to be, Lincoln was overjoyed. "I'm not going beyond the truth. When I tell you that the short space it took me to read your last letter gave me more pleasure than the total sum of all I've enjoyed since that fatal 1st of January, 1841. He might have left it at that, but he needed to make sure that Speed, after all his doubts and suffering, was happy. 8 months after the wedding, he asked bluntly, "Are you now, in feeling as well as in judgment, glad you're married as you are?" From anybody but me, he realized, this would be an impudent question not to be tolerated, but I know you'll pardon it in me. He had a reason for asking Speed to reply quickly, for he was once more approaching marriage with Mary Todd. After their rupture, the two had tried to avoid each other, but in a small town like Springfield, each was always conscious of what the other was doing. Then Mrs. Simeon Francis, wife of Lincoln's good friend, the editor of the Sangamo Journal, decided to intervene. Inviting both Lincoln and Mary to a social affair, she brought them face to face and enjoined, "Be friends again." Presently they began meeting at the Francis house, keeping the secret from everyone except Dr. Henry, who was carefully monitoring Lincoln's physical and emotional health, and Julia Jane, Mary's most intimate friend. They took special care not to let the Edwardses know, because after the engagement was broken, they'd bluntly told Mary that she and Lincoln had better not ever marry, that their natures, mind, education, raising, etc., were so different, they couldn't live happily as husband and wife. In these private meetings, the couple rediscovered that they had many interests in common, and their growing intimacy was given a special boost by a political contretemps. In February 1842, the State Bank of Illinois, which Lincoln had so often defended in the state legislature, had been forced to close, and its notes became worthless. As commerce virtually ceased throughout Illinois, State Auditor Shields quite properly issued a directive that the bank's notes would not be accepted in payment of taxes. Immediately, Whigs tried to take advantage of the crisis to attack the Democratic administration of the state, and especially Shields, who, next to Douglas, was the most prominent young Democrat in Illinois, almost certainly slated for higher office. No one took a more active part in this assault than Lincoln, who always had access to the columns of the Sangamo Journal. Picking up the pseudonym of someone who'd written several amusing letters to the editor from lost townships, he used the persona of Rebecca, a rough, uneducated, but shrewd countrywoman, to attack Democratic policies and to make fun of Shields. Effectively imitating the rural idiom, he reported Aunt Becca's conversation with Neighbor S., who claimed that the financial crisis was invented by the politicians, and that Shields' proclamation was a lie, and not a well-told one at that. "It grins out like a copper dollar. Shields is a fool as well as a liar. With him, truth is out of the question." Then, allowing his sense of humor free rein, Lincoln had Aunt Becca report her neighbor's description of Shields at a charitable fair the previous winter, attended by all the eligible young women of Springfield. "He was paying his money to this one and that one and t'other one. And the sweet distress he seemed to be in, His very features, in the ecstatic agony of his soul, spoke audibly and distinctly. "Dear girls, it is distressing, but I can't marry you all. Too well I know how much you suffer, but do remember, it's not my fault that I'm so handsome and so interesting." Obviously, Lincoln had fun writing his Lost Townships letter, and when he proudly showed his manuscript to Mary Todd and Julia Jane, they helped him sharpen its barbs before it appeared in the Sangamo Journal on September 2nd. Carried away by the excitement, the two young women decided to write their own letter, a rather clumsy effort that capitalized on the rumor that Shields was going to demand personal satisfaction for the insults he'd received. They had Aunt Rebecca offer, "Let him only come here, and he may squeeze my hand. If that ain't personal satisfaction, I can only say that he's the first man that was not satisfied with squeezing my hand." They followed this up with a doggerel signed Kathleen, announcing Shields' approaching marriage to Rebecca the Widow. In selecting Shields as the object of their ridicule, the three were playing a dangerous game. They'd attacked the state auditor at his most vulnerable points, for, though a man of good sense and excellent character, he had ornate and affected manners and fancied himself irresistible to women. Moreover, he had no sense of humor. Hot-tempered and excitable, Shields demanded that Simeon Francis reveal the name of his anonymous assailant. In order to protect the women, Lincoln authorized Francis to say he was responsible for all the Lost Townships letters. On September 17, 1842, Shields wrote Lincoln, requiring a full, positive, and absolute retraction of all offensive allusions used by you in these communications. The consequences of a refusal he didn't specify, but they did not need spelling out. Shields, an expert shot, was a military man, familiar with the protocol of the code duello. Shields's letter, borne by his designated friend, General John D. Whiteside, the state fund commissioner, reached Lincoln in Tremont, where he was attending the Tazewell County Circuit Court, and his initial reaction was that he was wholly opposed to dueling and would do anything to avoid it that might not degrade him in the estimation of himself and friends. Left to himself, he probably would have made peace with Shields, denying any intention to reflect on his character. But Lincoln made the mistake of consulting a hot-blooded young Springfield physician, Dr. Elias H. Merriman, who clearly wanted a duel to take place. Under Merriman's coaching, he refused to apologize, because Shields' letter had contained so much assumption of facts and so much of menace. He would, he told Merriman, fight before submitting to such degradation. After that, Whiteside brought Shields's challenge to a duel, and Lincoln named Merriman his second. As the party challenged, Lincoln had the right to name the weapons, and he chose broadswords. He'd had some experience with cavalry swords during the Black Hawk War, and under instruction from another young Springfield lawyer, Albert Taylor Bledsoe, he'd probably been exercising with them for some weeks. Anyway, he realized that with his height and long arms, broadswords would give him a considerable advantage over Shields, who was only 5 feet 9 inches tall. Lincoln took the proposed encounter with great seriousness. "I didn't intend to hurt Shields unless I did so clearly in self-defense," he said later. "If it had been necessary, I could have split him from the crown of his head to the end of his backbone." Because dueling was outlawed by the Illinois state constitution, with a penitentiary sentence of 1 to 5 years for those convicted of the offense, any encounter between Shields and Lincoln had to take place out of the state, and the parties agreed on a spot in Missouri, across the Mississippi River from Alton. Haste was necessary, for news of the impending duel had spread through Springfield, and arrests for all the participants were threatened. Accompanied by Merriman, Bledsoe, and William Butler, Lincoln arrived at Alton on September 22nd and crossed the river to the dueling ground, where they met Shields's party. Just as the encounter was about to begin, John J. Hardin, Lincoln's political associate and a relative of Mary Todd, and Dr. R. W. English intervened to try to stop the fight. As friends of both parties, they persuaded Shields to withdraw his insulting note so that Lincoln could disavow any intention of injuring the auditor's personal or private character or standing as a man or a gentleman, and claim that he wrote the Lost Township's correspondence solely for political effect. With that, the parties shook hands and returned to Illinois. The episode remained one of Lincoln's most painful memories. He was so ashamed of it that he and Mary mutually agreed never to speak of it. Years later, during the Civil War, when an impertinent army officer referred to the affair, Lincoln, with a flushed face, replied, "I do not deny it, but if you desire my friendship, you'll never mention it again." Of course, he was humiliated to remember that he'd acted foolishly, and he was embarrassed that, as a lawyer and officer of the court, he had deliberately violated the law. But what really hurt was the realization that he'd allowed himself to be ruled by his turbulent emotions. With anguish, he remembered how he'd so recently urged his fellow citizens to be guided by reason, cold, calculating, unimpassioned reason. But the Shields affair also had some unanticipated benefits. For one thing, it taught Lincoln a lesson about publishing anonymous letters. This practice, which probably dated back to his days as a freshman legislator in Vandalia, had led to the acrimonious exchanges with Adams in the Sampson's Ghost correspondence, and now to the dangerous encounter with Shields in the Lost Township's letters. Thereafter, Lincoln wrote no more such letters. It also helped him understand how painful the unintended effects of his undisciplined sense of humor could be. Rarely in the future did he use comedy to castigate and destroy. He'd learned that his wit was most effective when directed against himself. But the greatest positive result of the Shields encounter was the renewal of his engagement to Mary Todd, who was touched by his chivalry in covering her contributions to the Lost Township's letters. Encouraged by Speed's assurances that he was very happy with Fanny, Lincoln renewed his offer of marriage and was accepted. At the last possible moment, they informed the Edwardses, for, as she told her sister, "the world, woman, and man were uncertain and slippery, and it was best to keep the secret courtship from all eyes and ears." Elizabeth Edwards, who delighted in giving grand parties, had only a few hours to prepare for the wedding on November 4th. Lincoln was equally secretive, and he didn't ask James H. Matheny, his close friend who worked in the circuit court office, to act as his best man until late afternoon of the wedding day. As he prepared for the ceremony, Lincoln, like many another bridegroom, began to get cold feet. And Matheny recalled that he looked and acted as if he were going to the slaughter. While he was dressing and blacking his boots, Speed Butler, the son of his landlord, asked where he was going, And Lincoln replied, "To hell, I suppose." Despite the haste and the forebodings, the wedding ceremony, presided over by Episcopal minister Charles Dresser, went off without incident. And Lincoln placed on his wife's finger a ring engraved, "Love is eternal." Chapter 4. Always a Whig. "Nothing new here," Lincoln wrote a friend on November 11, 1842, "except my marrying, which to me is matter of profound wonder." In the years ahead, he was to have many occasions to wonder, for his marriage marked a change in the direction of his career. After 1842, his turbulent mood swings, which alternated between grandiosity and depression, were greatly moderated. He put himself on the steady course of a proper, aspiring member of the bourgeoisie. He became a parent and a householder. He assiduously cultivated his profession and business as a lawyer. And he became, what he'd belittled in his Lyceum speech, one of those great and good men sufficiently qualified for any task they should undertake, whose ambition would aspire to nothing beyond a seat in Congress, a gubernatorial or a presidential chair. The newlyweds took up residence in the Globe Tavern, a simple two-story wooden structure on the north side of Adams Street, between 3rd and 4th Streets. It had about 30 rooms, mostly for transients, but in addition, according to its advertisement, it offered 8 pleasant and comfortable rooms for boarders. There, for $4 a week, the Lincolns occupied an 8-by-14-foot room on the second floor and took their meals in the common dining room. This wasn't an unusual arrangement for a young married couple. John Todd Stewart had taken his wife to the Globe for a time after their marriage. Indeed, Mary Lincoln's sister Frances and her husband, Dr. William Wallace, had stayed for 3 years in the very room that the Lincolns occupied. Though the Globe was a respectable hotel, its accommodations were inferior to those of its principal competitor, the American House, and it was often noisy. Lincoln, who was away at his law office most of the days when he was not out traveling the judicial circuit, was happy enough with the Globe Tavern. Indeed, it was probably the most comfortable place he'd ever resided. For Mary, the hotel was a come-down after her father's spacious house in Lexington and the Edwardses' luxurious mansion. For the first time in her life, she had no personal servants or slaves, no place to store or display her possessions, no private room where she could receive callers. To add to her discomfort, the proprietor of the Globe was stingy, scanting his guests on food and begrudging them candles. But she voiced no dissatisfaction with her lot, nor did she complain when her sisters, who'd warned her against an unsuitable marriage, largely dropped her from their social circle. She was so much in love with her husband that she was willing to live a very quiet, almost secluded life, and the name of this formerly lively, sociable young woman virtually disappeared from Springfield letters and gossip. Pregnancy helped account for the remarkable transformation. The sexual fears Lincoln had voiced before marriage proved groundless, and very soon Mary knew she was expecting a baby. She may not have told her husband right away, for in March, Lincoln, in response to a jovial inquiry from Speed, wrote, "About the prospect of your having a namesake at our house, can't say exactly yet." But by May, Springfield was buzzing about coming events in the Lincoln family, and William Butler wrote Speed the news. When Speed made further inquiry, Lincoln responded jokingly, "I hadn't heard one word before I got your letter, but I have so much confidence in the judgment of a butler on such a subject that I incline to think there may be some reality in it. What day does Butler appoint?" On August 1, 1843, just 3 days short of 9 months after the wedding, the Lincolns' first child was born. They named him Robert Todd Lincoln, after Mary's father. In this trying period, Lincoln did his best to be supportive, and after Robert's birth, Mary awoke to see her darling husband bending over me with such love and tenderness. But such displays of affection were rare. As Mary said years later, Lincoln was not a demonstrative man. When he felt most deeply, he expressed the least. The relationship between husband and wife was never an equal one. She always addressed him, in formal Victorian style, as Mr. Lincoln. Before they were married, he sometimes called her Molly, but now in his letters he referred to her as Mary. In private he called her Puss, and, more significantly, Little Woman or Child Wife. After Robert's birth, he always addressed her as Mother. Realizing that they couldn't raise a family in a hotel room, the Lincolns began looking for a house of their own. But money was scarce. Lincoln no longer had his salary from the legislature, and his income from his law practice had diminished during the final months of his partnership with Stuart. Joining with Logan opened the prospect of a brighter future, but it offered no immediate increase in Lincoln's income. He was probably still paying off some of the debts he'd accumulated during his New Salem days, and he felt obliged to contribute to the support of his father and stepmother, who were now settled in Coles County, on an unprofitable homestead called Goose Nest Prairie. The best the Lincolns could do was to rent a small three-room frame house on South 4th Street, to which they moved in the fall of 1843. There, Robert S. Todd, Mary's father, found them shortly before Christmas, when he came to visit his four daughters who lived in Springfield and to inspect his newest grandchild and namesake. Todd took a great liking to his son-in-law, who was already representing him in a highly technical case before the Sangamon County Circuit Court, involving some Illinois lands Todd had purchased. Todd was obviously touched by the meagerness of Mary's surroundings, and without comment dropped a gold piece in her hand. Afterward, he arranged for her to receive $120 a year for the rest of his lifetime, a considerable sum, which would more than cover the cost of hiring a maid at $1.50 a week. Todd also deeded to the Lincolns, as he did to each of his other married Springfield daughters and their husbands, 80 acres of Illinois land. By 1844, the Lincolns felt able to buy a home of their own, and they purchased a cottage on the corner of 8th and Jackson Streets, owned by the Reverend Charles Dresser, the Episcopal minister who'd married them. It was small, to be sure. On the ground floor there were three rooms, a parlor, a sitting room, and a kitchen. In the half-loft above there were two bedrooms, but the ceilings under the sloping roof slanted so that there was only a small area, about 4 feet wide, in which Lincoln could stand erect. Over the kitchen there was an attic, used for storage or as a maid's room. The downstairs rooms were heated by fireplaces, and there were wood-burning stoves in the upstairs bedrooms. Of course, there was no gas or electric light. Water came from a cistern and a well in the backyard. A latrine near the back fence offered the only sanitary facilities. Despite its limitations, it was a sturdy, well-built house, and the Lincolns thought it worth every penny of what it cost, $1,200, plus a town lot on Adams Street, which Lincoln owned, valued at $300. Running a household required money, and Lincoln set about earning it with greater energy than he'd ever before demonstrated. A few years later, in notes he prepared for a lecture on the legal profession, he began, "The leading rule for the lawyer, as for the man of every calling, is diligence." He was speaking from experience. He worked incessantly, handling virtually every kind of business that could come before a prairie lawyer. In the early months of his partnership with Stephen T. Logan, he spent much of his time in appearances before the United States District Court under the Bankruptcy Act, which went into effect on February 1, 1842. Designed to allow businessmen to escape some of the losses brought about by the unrelenting Depression, the Act permitted federal judges to declare petitioners bankrupt if their debts were greater than their assets. Of the 1,742 applicants in Illinois, nearly all employed lawyers. Before the law was repealed in 1843, Logan and Lincoln handled 77 of these cases, a number exceeded by only three other firms in the entire state. In most of these cases, which generally were uncontested, they earned fees of $10. Though bankruptcy cases provided a welcome source of income during the first year of Lincoln's marriage, most of his earnings came from office work, like drafting wills and petitions, from petty suits before the justices of the peace or county commissioners, and especially from actions before the Sangamon County Circuit Court. On a single day at fall term of that court in November 1842, for instance, Logan and Lincoln had 17 cases. They represented Thomas W. Sparks in his suit against Henry and Thomas Byrd, who, he claimed, unlawfully withheld the possession of 106 acres of land. They appeared in behalf of John R. Herndon, administrator of the estate of John Wilson, who complained that one Seth Cutter failed to pay $220 for goods he'd purchased. They obtained a divorce for John Jackson from his wife Maria, and so on and on. Business was so good that the partners could afford to leave their crowded quarters on North Fifth Street and move to the premier business location in Springfield, the newly constructed Tinsley Building, on the southwest corner of 6th and Adams Streets. The post office occupied the ground floor, and the United States District Court, before which both Logan and Lincoln frequently appeared, was on the second floor. Their office was just above it, in the front room, overlooking both the state capitol and the county courthouse. Billy Herndon, who was studying law with Logan and Lincoln, described how Lincoln dealt with a prospective client. He would listen to the man's story well, patiently, occasionally now and then breaking in as the story progressed by asking a question. The man would answer it, and then he'd proceed and end his story. After the man had finished, Lincoln would often say, "I'm not exactly satisfied about some point. Come into the office in an hour or so, and I'll give you my opinion, a positive one." When the client returned, Lincoln might say, "You're in the right," and they would proceed to draw up the papers leading to a suit. But he might also tell the client, You're in the wrong of the case, and I'd advise you to compromise. Don't bring a suit on the facts of your case, because you're in the wrong. Lincoln learned much from Logan, unquestionably the leading figure in the Sangamon County Bar. 9 years older than Lincoln, Logan had made a name for himself as Commonwealth's attorney in his native Kentucky, before moving to Illinois, where his merits were so promptly recognized that he was elected circuit court judge. In that position, he'd certified Lincoln's enrollment in the Sangamon County Bar in 1837. Unhappy over the meager compensation given judges, he resigned and returned to private practice with Edward D. Baker, a spellbinding orator who could mesmerize juries. Logan's sharp analytical mind and his knowledge of legal precedents and technicalities made him a formidable opponent in the courtroom. But his harsh, cracked voice kept him from becoming an effective public speaker, and juries were often put off by his wizened figure and his wrinkled countenance, topped by a mass of frowsy hair. It was to compensate for these deficiencies that, after the breakup of his partnership with Baker, Logan turned to Lincoln, thinking, as he said later, "He'd be exceedingly useful to me in getting the goodwill of juries." Lincoln's years as a surveyor and his service in the state legislature had given him a wide range of acquaintances. It was hard to find anyone in Sangamon County who didn't recognize his lanky figure, and his remarkable memory enabled him to identify by name, residence, and family connections nearly every person called to jury duty. In the courtroom, Lincoln maintained that personal connection, seeming to speak to each juror individually and in a conversational tone. He rarely used technical language, and he was a master of the homespun anecdote to illustrate his point. In a McLean County case where a physician claimed that a man charged with murder was insane, evidencing that he frequently picked at his head, Lincoln, appearing for the state, skillfully deflated the doctor's testimony. "Now," he remarked, "I sometimes pick my head, and those joking fellows at Springfield tell me that there may be a living, moving cause for it, and that the trouble isn't at all on the inside. It's only a case for fine-tooth combs." He knew the importance of an effective summing-up statement. In a lecture prepared for young lawyers, he advised, "Extemporaneous speaking should be practiced and cultivated. It's the lawyer's avenue to the public. However able and faithful he may be in other respects, people are slow to bring him business if he can't make a speech." But he also knew that lawyers couldn't make a more fatal error than relying too much on speech-making, instead of looking up precedents and logically examining the evidence. In his concluding remarks to a jury, he usually spoke from a short but carefully prepared outline, and he avoided the flowery pastures of rhetoric into which he'd strayed in his Lyceum and Temperance lectures. As he warned Herndon, "Billy, don't shoot too high. Aim lower and the common people'll understand you. They're the ones you want to reach." To Logan's surprise, Lincoln proved to be much more than a courtroom litigator. Up to this point, his knowledge of the law was, as Logan recalled, very small, for he'd largely imitated Stewart, who never went much upon the law. But now he began to pick up a considerable ambition in the law. Observing the care and precision with which his senior partner drafted his pleadings, Lincoln sought to make his own equally succinct and correct. On occasion, he'd seek Logan's advice on technical points. Very early in the partnership, representing the plaintiff in a slander case, Lincoln drew up a declaration charging that the defendant had called his client a damned rogue. Reviewing the document, Lincoln recognized that the words, though offensive, were not legally significant, and inserted the necessary formula, "And the plaintiff says that the defendant thereby meant and intended to charge the plaintiff with the crime of larceny, and that he was so understood by those who heard him." Mostly, though, Lincoln learned by reading. Logan's example taught him that there was more to the law than common sense and simple equity, and he began studying procedures and precedents. The partners had no considerable law library of their own, but after the Illinois Supreme Court moved into its quarters in the State House in 1841, attorneys had access to an excellent collection of legal reports and standard reference works. Lincoln never did become a devoted reader of general texts or theoretical books on the law. Years later, Herndon claimed that Lincoln never thoroughly read any elementary law book. "In fact, I never knew him to read through and through any law book of any kind." The charge was largely true. "I can't read generally. I never read textbooks, for I have no particular motive to drive and whip me to it," Lincoln explained. "I don't and can't remember such reading." But Herndon's remark was really beside the point, for Lincoln spent night after night in the Supreme Court library searching out precedents that applied to the cases he was working on. This was work he enjoyed. "When I have a particular case in hand," he explained, "I love to dig up the question by the roots and hold it up and dry it before the fires of the mind." Logan's final judgment on Lincoln's legal accomplishments was more perceptive than Herndon's. "I don't think he studied very much. I think he learned his law more in the study of cases. He got to be a pretty good lawyer, though his general knowledge of law was never very formidable. But he'd study out his case and make about as much of it as anybody." Lincoln's growing mastery of the law became evident in his increasingly frequent appearances before the Illinois Supreme Court. In his earliest ventures before the High Court, he based his case on the hair-splitting technicalities of which young lawyers are so often fond. In 1841, for instance, he represented a man named Amos Worthing, who'd won a verdict in the Tazewell County Circuit Court, which his opponent, Jacob Mouse, appealed. The law required Mouse to post an appeal bond, a document guaranteeing that he would pay the costs of the appeal if he lost. The bond was supposed to be under seal. In earlier days, signatures on such legal documents had been attested by the impression of a signet ring in sealing wax. But by the 1840s, a signer merely made a vaguely circular scrawl looking something like a child's drawing of a puffy cloud under his name. Discovering that Mouse's surety had carelessly failed to add such a scrawl below his signature, Lincoln asked the Supreme Court to dismiss the case. A majority of the judges agreed, to the dismay of Justice Sidney Breese, who dissented. "The rule seems to me to be destitute of any good reason on which to base it, and altogether too technical for this age." In subsequent years, Lincoln had many more cases before the Illinois Supreme Court, but perhaps through Logan's influence, they less and less frequently depended on such technicalities. He came to feel very much at home in this court, where, as Herndon said, an attorney had ample time to read the record and gather up the facts of the case, the issues, and the law arising thereon. The court required attorneys to prepare abstracts of the case, stating the facts in a condensed form and the issues made thereby. The Supreme Court limited oral arguments and made its decisions largely on the basis of these written briefs, which were sometimes elaborate, with extensive citations of precedents. In preparing his presentations for the court, Lincoln took nothing for granted, and frequently offered precedents that stretched back to the beginnings of English common law. When Herndon asked why he went to so much trouble, he responded, "I dare not trust this case on the presumptions that this court knows all things. I argued the case on the presumption that the court didn't know anything." His care and thoroughness made him one of the most successful practitioners before the court, and by the time he left for Washington in 1861, he'd appeared before the highest court in Illinois in at least 300 cases.
This ends Disc 5.